Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to do some severe damage to a Beatles song now called I Am Der Walrus.
I'm crying, sitting on a corner bank, waiting for the day to come. A couple with your t-shirts, singing Bunny Tuesday, man, you've been a naughty boy, you let your face go wrong. I am the Ed Man, yeah. And I'm the Ed Man, yeah. Girl, you let your cornhole down. I am the Eggman. They are the Eggman. I am the walrus. The girls are true. Sitting in an English garden, waiting for the sun. If the sun don't come, you get a tan from standing in the English rain. I am the Eggman. They are the Eggman. I am the walrus. The go-go-go-go, go-go-go-go-go-go. Expert, joking smokers, don't you think the joker mess with you? Say, I'm the guy like kicks in a spicy Harley's night. I'm crying. I'm an Eiffel Tower. I'm a Richie Baker singing our Krishna band. You should have seen him kick the nigga out of the book. I am the Eggman. I am the Eggman. I am the walrus. Go, 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 go.
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program includes Scott Horton interviews Daniel Ellsberg from January 4th, 2001. Daniel Ellsberg, the man who leaked the Pentagon Papers, discusses the destabilization of Pakistan, how counterinsurgencies often provoke civil war, and the underestimation of Israel's nuclear arsenal. This is about an hour. And then after that, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change by Elizabeth Kohlberg. This is about 27 minutes.
Well, do you think that it is designed? I mean, I think you sort of misspoke and corrected yourself there, but maybe that is the purpose of it, is to destabilize the whole thing for the long term.
That isn't to be ruled out, but I'll give you an analogy. What I was about to say was that let's just think back to 2002 or 2003 when we were told that we were going to protect ourselves from terrorists in the world by attacking Iraq. It was exactly the opposite of what it's true. Now, there's no question, and CIA has estimated this, that Osama bin Laden not only was delighted at our attack on Iraq and Afghanistan, but had intended that from the late 90s and the early years of this century, that his desire was to draw us in to an attack on Muslim lands that would recruit people worldwide for Al-Qaeda, which it has done. So it definitely played into his hands. He was very happy about that. And by the same, you could almost say, well, then does that mean that Bush was in the pay of Osama? I think not.
It seem like it sometimes, though, doesn't it?
I know there are people in this audience, friends of mine too, who will entertain that hypothesis. And I'm not saying they.
Well, they'll say it's the other way around. Osama works for Bush all along. Kind
either of. Way, you know, they're together. There's no question. There was a synergy there. Listen, looking back at Westmoreland's search and destroy methods of attrition, which brought American troops into the jungle to be ambushed, essentially at the will of the North Vietnamese and of the NLF, and just to attrit U.S. troops. Granted, we were killing 10-1 in the jungles there for everyone we lost, but they were more easily able to replace the 10 they lost than we were the 1 in terms of political support. Ours were dying thousands of miles away from their home. Theirs essentially were at home, and they're the brothers and cousins and sisters of the people who were killed filled those ranks, and not so quickly back here. So looking at that strategy, you could have inferred that Westmoreland was actually working for Hanoi, but I didn't, and I don't. I think that's the way it was. It's just that generals and presidents are capable of doing what is just the worst thing for their country, and in some cases that will correspond to what's best for an adversary.
Well, you know, stop me and correct me if there's a flaw in my theory here, but I guess I sort of, you know, for honesty's sake, I have to sort of give Petraeus credit here in that, I mean, mostly his taking power coincided with the end of the Civil War there, but the previous generals running the war in Iraq, Abizaid and Casey and Sanchez and all these guys, I forget who all was the general and who all was the head of CENTCOM at the various times, but that's what they did, seek and destroy, Phoenix mission type stuff, Phoenix operation stuff against the people of Iraq, and a million people died in the Civil War that they touched off with that. You know, I remember talking with Dar Jamail about, you know, a big part of the Civil War, if you went back and traced the cause and effect back, it was the second assault on Fallujah after the re-election of George Bush in November of 2004 that caused so many Sunni refugees to have to flee and go try to stay with relatives in Baghdad, which of course forced a bunch of Shiites out of their houses in predominantly Sunni neighborhoods. So then they became refugees, and a bunch of Sunnis got forced out of predominantly Shiite neighborhoods where they were going to stay with their relatives. And this is really using the El Salvador option, they called, of hiring the Shiite death squads to hunt down the leaders of the Sunni insurgency. This whole search and destroy thing is what tore Iraq apart. I mean, you know, overthrowing the Baathists and whatever is going to lead to a bunch of chaos no matter what. But they couldn't have waged that war more wrong. I mean, if Petraeus deserves any credit at all, it's just calling the troops back to their bases, closing down a lot of the checkpoints, and getting them off the streets. Right?
Well, to say that, yes, that's the way that it should work. And that's to say that there was less violence, as you say, when American troops withdrew from the street-by-street combat.
Giraldi made the same point when we were talking about suicide terrorism the other day, how in Lebanon, when the Israelis withdrew from southern Lebanon, all Hezbollah suicide bombings stopped. There hadn't been one since they left. And how when they withdrew from a lot of their further occupation in the West Bank, that's what ended the last intifada there. They finally said, okay, here, and they withdrew to their bases, and the suicide bombing stopped.
Well, you mentioned Robert Tate earlier, who has made, I think, the single really comprehensive study of suicide bombing in the last generation, studying virtually every case. And in looking at the pattern, he found an almost perfect correlation in the following ways, that suicide bombing occurs when there is an issue of foreign occupation, and second, when that foreign occupation is associated with a religious difference, when there's a religious element in that. And the of course, we fit both of those categories when they're entering into Afghanistan right now. But even with, aside from us, imperial policies always, for millennia, going back to the Romans and the British and the Soviets and everyone else, have exploited rivalries between ethnic groups. The notion of divide and conquer is an imperial notion of thousands of years old and always tried and true. We hear a lot about counterinsurgency now and pacification. A subject, by the way, which I was 100% involved in Vietnam. That was my area in Vietnam for 2 years, evaluating pacification and actually writing doctrine for counterinsurgency or pacification in Vietnam. And the idea, by the way, that if we'd done it right there, we would have won, which I think is the basis for a lot of what's going on in Afghanistan right now, is, I believe, a simply false lesson. It's not the case that we had any chance of either applying it right or if it's working, if we can apply right. And it's not going to work now, but I wanted, in Afghanistan, but I wanted to make a point that I think is very unfamiliar. The essence of that is to get local people, native people, as the imperial power calls them, you know, the natives, indigenous people, locals, to fight for the imperial power against the independence of their country. That generally turns out to be possible to one degree or another, especially by exploiting ethnic splits of various kinds. In Vietnam, we relied on Catholics, for example, who were a minority in that Buddhist country, an animist country, to work for the imperial power. The French did that, and we relied on them too. But the effect of that is that if you get enough people to work for you, the imperial power, the foreigners, you have a fighting force there that is fighting against other groups or other ethnic groups, the insurgents, the resistance, which may be the majority, in their own country. And what you get then is a civil war. What starts as a war of invasion, of foreign occupation, is converted, if the occupier is successful, if we get in Afghanistan what we're trying to do, we generate a civil war of people who will work for us, the foreigners, working, fighting against and dying and killing against countrymen who are fighting for independence of their country against the foreigners. So a civil war is not something you intervene into. It's something you generate to a large extent in order to serve your own imperial purposes.
It's Anti-War Radio. I'm talking with the heroic whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, the guy that stole the Pentagon Papers and almost got life in prison for it. And now this is such an important point. I want to dwell here for a minute. You're telling me, Dan, that you were the General Sanchez of Vietnam. You were writing up this search and destroy kind of program that didn't work. Is that what you're telling me?
No. Certainly, I was not a General Sanchez, and I was not a General Westmoreland. What I was a civilian working for the State Department.
Well, I know that. You know what I mean.
I'm a low level. Well, I was that low level. I was a FSR-1, as a matter of fact, which is the highest civil service level. So as a civilian, it was reasonably high. But I was working on, in the embassy, writing the one in concept for what they called revolutionary development, which was a term that Lodge and others seized on. Sounded somehow better than pacification, which is French, pacification. So these are French concepts, which we're hearing right now, and counterinsurgency from French colonial warfare in Algeria, Morocco, and Indochina, going back to the 19th century.
Right, because the European empires are the model that America followed.
The idea was, yes, that the locals who were resisting, who were always called terrorists and gangsters by the occupying power, the idea is to find ways to confront them with people who will work for the empire, people who work for the emperor for various reasons. In Vietnam, for instance, some of those people had sentimental feelings toward the emperor, who allied himself with the French at the imperial fort Bao Dai. And Catholics, as they say, who a lot of whom had converted to Catholicism because the French had influenced that. The way to get ahead in the army was to be Catholic, and that's how Nguyen Thieu, for example, converted to Catholicism on that basis, the president we relied on toward the end. So what I was doing then was, in particular, my job was as an observer, really, to go through, I went through 38 of the 43 provinces, looking at how we were doing and the kinds of things that McChrystal is laying out as his tasks right now. When I read McChrystal's report of what had to be done and what the obstacles were and so forth, it had a very familiar ring to me. I thought, well, gee, I could have written that 30 years ago. In fact, I realized I had written it
Well, so Dan, help me understand, because I'm a total novice at this stuff.
But exactly the same report.
Yeah. So what you're telling me then is basically the narrative, the very thin narrative, obviously, is that in the Vietnam War they had this this terrible policy of search and destroy, like you said, just sending troops out to be ambushed and getting nothing done except creating more enemies.
The alternative, in theory, was a counterinsurgency strategy, but would that have worked? It wasn't really tried. No, it was.
Right, I mean, that's what I'm getting at, is that you're telling me what you developed was what they're now calling their advanced clear, hold, and build kind of thing.
And what I was working on and advocating, and I came to conclude while in Vietnam that it would not have worked. It was not going to be implemented in the way it was imagined to start with. And second, with American troops who don't speak the language, who don't know the religion, don't know the culture, but above all, and it wasn't going to work even best implemented, and the reason is this: the theory of it is to acquire the, as they said, the hearts and minds, the allegiance of the people there for government representatives of a government essentially selected by us, by the foreigners, as in Afghanistan right now, so that they will give their loyalty to a foreign-controlled and selected government working in the interests of foreigners. And with this loyalty that they give them, they will then be able, they will be willing to give information on the guerrillas, who will no longer be able to hide themselves in the population or in the jungles or in the mountains. Mm-hmm. They'll be able to find them and destroy them. And the reason that that is not going to happen is very simply this, that the majority of the population may or may not see those activists, those militants, the rebels, the independence fighters, as people they really would choose to run their country if they had a free choice, which they've never had, perhaps never will have. They're not their chosen representatives necessarily, but they are recognized as leaders in the fight to expel foreigners from their country. And as such, the population is not going to inform on them to the foreigners. They're not going to give us, the Americans, the information necessary to find, torture, kill.
Well, now let me stop you there for a second, because I don't know if this really makes a difference or not. Help me out. But it seems like if you're going to be an empire, you have to support the minority so that they need you. Right, this is why the Belgians propped up the Tutsis over the Hutus, because there were fewer of them, and so they would rely on the foreigners to prop them up in power. And this is what we're doing. This is what we did not do. What our empire did not do in Iraq. They overthrew the minority that, of course, had been for many years dependent on the West to prop them up, and installed the majority, which has now told us, thanks, now get the hell out of our country, and so we're leaving. But it looks like in Afghanistan, what they're doing is they're installing the Tajiks and the Hazaras and the Uzbeks, at least. As Gareth Porter and Patrick Coburn and others have reported, the army is, the leadership of the so-called Afghan army is almost exclusively Tajik now, and becoming more and more that way. And maybe that's a great way to do it, right? Is to prop up the minority, that way they need us, the Northern Alliance, basically, in a perpetual low-scale, low-level war against the Taliban that will never end either way. You know, the Taliban will never be able to overthrow them as long as they have our backing, but we'll never be able to defeat the Taliban either. That sounds kind of perfect if you're the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Policy or something, right?
If what you want is permanent war, and that may be what some elements in our army actually want, to keep busy at permanent war. Apparently, the doctrine of counterinsurgency has taken over the army and thus opposed the people who emphasize the tanks, the artillery, the air power, the heavy army that showed itself its abilities, its very good abilities when it came to Blitzkrieg in the first part of the Iraq War. But what has come to power apparently in the army are people who say, no, the future is in putting down rebellion in the lands we occupy, generally, and counterinsurgency. And for that purpose, they really do, to my amazement, seem willing to contemplate a future of essentially permanent war. And when they talk about, you know, the chief of staff of the army in Britain, when he came into office earlier this year, last year, made an offhand comment that 40 or 50 years of war might lie ahead. Well, that burst of candor, you know, got him immediate reproof from Whitehall. Had to back off a bit.
Yeah, you're not supposed to tell the trolls that.
40, 50 years, 100 years from now.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's against the principles of Ingsoc to let the people know that their great-grandson is going to die killing Pashtuns, you know? That's a secret, I think. Well, back to Vietnam for a second here, because I'm trying to get my head wrapped around, you know, real reality as versus the shape of letters on pages. You know what I mean? There's the truth, and then there's the truth. And I saw this thing last two or three weeks ago, Dan, called American Holocaust. It's a movie, I guess it's narrated by one of them famous Hollywood guys or something. And, yeah, boy, oh boy, it really describes an American Holocaust. It describes war crime on top of war crime in Vietnam, where, you know, I've known this my whole life, basically. I was born right after the Vietnam War ended, basically, a year after the war finally was over or whatever. So I've kind of grown up my whole life with these stories, and I guess maybe now that I'm approaching my mid-30s or whatever, I just have a little bit of a different perspective, and I saw this movie that put, you know, a lot of information I'd already heard kind of in a new context for me, and, well, the reality of it was absolutely sickening, if indeed that was the reality of it. Throwing people out of helicopters for fun, spraying them with every kind of chemical weapon and every kind of explosive, napalm and cluster bombs and white phosphorus that they could possibly use, carpet bombing North Vietnam, basically off the face of the earth, killing, you know, somewhere between 3 and 5 million Vietnamese. How's that for missing in action? A couple of million that we don't even know, because everybody who knew them is dead too, so there's nobody even to say that they're dead. I mean, was that really what happened in Vietnam? Is that really what this country did to that one, Dan?
Well, are you asking that rhetorically, because the simple answer?
Well, I mean, maybe it was a bunch of commies who put together this propaganda and they really portray it falsely. I don't know.
No, it was Robert McNamara who gave the estimate in 1995 in his book that 3 to 4 million Vietnamese had been killed. That was, by the way, something that the Defense Department very assiduously failed or refused to collect during the time, or claims that they did. How many are we killing? With all the body count of supposedly enemy Viet Cong, although they said any dead Vietnamese is a Viet Cong for the purpose of their body count, no matter a small girl. But they refused really ever to estimate. I remember asking at one point Henry Kissinger, I guess it was the last time that I actually saw him, at a conference before the Pentagon Papers came out at MIT, and asking him, what's your best estimate of the number of people that, actually at first I said Vietnamese, that we will kill in the next 12 months? Had estimates of how much gasoline you need, what the effects will be on this and that, and what the cost will be, how many people will die. And he was very taken aback, and he said it was, you're accusing us of racism. And I said Vietnamese. I said, no, let me change.
I'm sorry, Dan, that's a great Kissinger impression, but it's a little thick of an accent. What was that in English?
Because you're accusing us of racism. And I said, no, it's just, you know, how many people, how many humans will die?
Yeah. By the way,
little Johnny Brown, spread your comfort down. Little Johnny Brown, spread your comfort down. Little Johnny Brown, spread your comfort down.
Hold another corner. Won't you fold another corner?
Johnny Brown.
Fold another corner.
Johnny Brown.
Won't you fold another corner?
Johnny Brown.
And take it to your lover.
Oh, Johnny Brown.
Take it to your lover.
Oh, Johnny Brown.
Take it to your lover.
Johnny Brown.
Take it to your lover.
Johnny Brown.
And little Johnny Brown.
Johnny Brown,
spread your comfort, look like the buzzard.
Johnny Brown,
to look like a buzzard.
Johnny Brown.
Look like a buzzard.
Johnny Brown.
Oh, look like a buzzard.
Oh, Johnny Brown.
Now show her your motions.
Johnny Brown.
Won't you show her your motions?
Johnny Brown.
Show her your motions.
Johnny Brown.
Won't you show her your motions?
Johnny Brown.
Little Johnny Brown. Spread your comfort down. Oh, little Johnny Brown. Spread your comfort down. Little Johnny Brown. Spread your comfort. Show her your motion.
Johnny Brown.
Show her your motion.
Johnny Brown.
Won't you show her your motion?
Johnny Brown.
Show her your motion.
Johnny Brown.
And loaf like a buzzard.
Johnny Brown.
Buzzard.
Johnny Brown.
Won't you look like a buzzard?
Johnny Brown.
Look like a buzzard.
Johnny Brown.
Little Johnny Brown.
Oh, spread your comfort down.
Oh, little Johnny Brown. Spread your comfort down. Little Johnny Brown. Spread your comfort. Show her your motion.
Johnny Brown.
Show her your motion.
Johnny Brown.
Won't you show her your motion?
Johnny Brown.
Show her your motion.
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 Oh, Johnny Brown.
Melanie DeBoer, little Johnny Brown.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.